Many don't believe that either the trumpets with melodious noise or the infernal din await us where the road ends. But most, I fancy, have discovered that to be born is to be exposed to delights and miseries greater than imagination could have anticipated. That the choice of ways at any crossroads may be more important than we think, and that shortcuts may lead to very nasty places.
Model of a modern major general of information, vegetable, animal, and mineral. I know the kings of England, and I quote the fights historical from Marathon to Waterloo in order categorical. I'm very well acquainted too with matters mathematical. I understand equations both simple and quadratical. About binomial theorem, I'm teeming with a lot of news, with many cheerful facts about the square of the hypotenuse.
I'm very good at integral and differential calculus. I know the scientific names of beings and immaculous. In short, in matters vegetable, animal, and mineral, I am the very model of a modern major general.
I know our mythic history, King Arthur's, and Sir Carodorox. I answer hard acrostics and I'm pretty paced for paradox. I quote the Clariacs, all the crimes of Heligarbugus, and conics I can floor up on a conic and Bacarbugus. I can none doubt about a rat's 1,000 gunner prince Dacrinus. I know a croaking chorus from the frogs of Orthophanias. Man, I'm good at this.
You are good.
I should just move to Hollywood and start auditioning for musicals. It just comes so natural. I mean, it's part of my being, don't you think?
Yes, it's like calculus. I was doing good earlier. I could go all the way through that first paragraph, but I didn't see calculus coming.
Well, this is one that it's best not to think ahead, you see. Do you see how I handled the end of that last piece that I did?
Yeah, you were just kind of improvising your way through that. That's the real talent.
Real class, real talent and class.
Yeah, I can't use the word class anymore without thinking about He Who Shall Not Be Named. So
you fudged and slurred your way through the difficult passages.
I did. Yes, but I have spent my time far better. So anyway, today we are going to be talking about musicals, if you couldn't tell already. So we're going to be focusing mostly on Singing in the Rain, the musical Singing in the Rain, which we just listened and watched. But we're also going to be doing a little bit of a historical examination of the American musical theater. And because everybody's been talking about Hamilton all summer, and I have finally gotten around to listening to it, or at least listening to the first half of it on Amazon Prime, so I haven't finished it yet, but we need to introduce ourselves. Today we're joined by Gilbert and Sullivan. Actually, I'm the progeny. I have the patriarch here, also the matriarch over in the corner.
Hello.
And somebody who... Okay, no, I'm not supposed to... Okay. You're not here either? Okay, no. several other people who are not here.
The studio audience.
The studio audience, yes. Though, that reminds me, we had some comments from last time. In our last episode, we discussed The Force Awakens, and that was back on January 4th, actually, 20 days ago.
Well.
But, Sarah, my sister Sarah, was on the podcast, and we had not come up with a name for her, so Daryl chimed in and had a few suggestions, including Sibling X, which I think is pretty cool. The Reluctant Sibling, Progeny X2, the Quiet Progeny, the Shy Progeny. She would comment, but...
I like the Reluctant Sibling.
The Reluctant Sibling? I think Sibling X is pretty cool. What do you think, Sibling X? There you have it.
We'll take that as a yes.
Well, I guess we're still discussing it, but anyway, that is it, I think, for just, we don't have any other comments, but musicals. What do you guys know about musicals?
They're great.
The Matriarch likes musicals.
They have music and singing and dancing.
What's your favorite musical?
Oh, boy, that's a tough one.
Anybody
I've
else
always
have Grish-
loved The Sound of Music, and I really enjoyed Singing in the Rain, the dance that Gene Kelly did out in the rain by himself.
Yeah, that was great.
Fantastic. So that one was really good. But it's tough because I like The Phantom of the Opera. That's one of my favorite ones. Now that Ramin, what is
Karam
it?
Lou.
Yeah.
No. Yeah.
He makes for a more convincing Phantom.
And he's hot.
Well, that don't hurt.
All right, Patriarch. So what's your favorite musical?
Oh, I don't have one. I mean, it's just too many to, it's like, I don't think so. I don't
when
think
you got something you
oh,
like,
I like
what's the use?
I'd say Les Miserables, probably. I'd say Les Miserables.
Okay, anybody else who, turning it over to the studio audience, any favorites? I would say, and we're going to get into all this and stuff, but I don't know about my favorite, but I think that objectively, Singing in the Rain is the best musical. Wait a minute. Just the best Hollywood musical because it actually, it makes sense. It's very meta, you know. It makes sense that it's a musical about musicals. It's a movie about movies. You know, it's about Hollywood. It's set in Hollywood. You know, it's all very self-conscious, and it's like, you know, if somebody starts singing, it's because they're a movie star. That's what they do. You know, and it makes sense that they would sing to their true love because that's what they're trained to do. And that brings us into the concept of what's called a book musical. Now, a lot of this draws from opera, you see. An opera, the first composition considered to be an opera was called Daphne, and it was written in 1597.
Wow.
And opera springs from the Roman and Greek theater traditions, which hadn't come up with a musical as such, but there was music involved, and opera finally made music what the story was about. It was really a story which was made to showcase great singers, and that was the point of it. And that got its start in Italy in 1597. The first musical came out in 1866, what's considered to be the first musical theater piece, and it was called The Black Crook. It ran for a record-breaking 474 performances, despite its 5.5-hour length. So people were committed.
Yeah.
You know, it's like Hamlet. Hamlet, you know, people would go to see Hamlet, and it lasts 4 hours.
What a treat.
Yeah. As poverty ebbed and transportation became more convenient, the audience for the theater broadened. More people could get to the city. More people could come in. You know, people from different parts of life, too. So it became more of something which connected all parts of society. Now, in the late 1800s, you had, and early 1900s, you had Gilbert and Sullivan, who were a couple of English fellows who wrote a series of exceedingly popular comic operas. The Mikado, HMS Pinafore, and the Pirates of Penzance are the best known. We were just singing a number from the Pirates of Penzance.
Yes, I was going to ask you what that was from.
Yes, I haven't actually watched or listened to any of the others, so who knows what the context for that song is, but it was fun to sing. I am the very model of a modern major general. And
is that one very well known?
Oh, yes,
Alan?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know it, but I've never seen it. But it was made into a movie in the, I don't know, 70s or 80s, probably the 80s.
So you were just familiar with that song?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'd heard bits and pieces of it before.
I've never heard it.
Mm-hmm.
It's new to me.
W.S. Gilbert was the librettist, and Arthur Sullivan was the composer. Now, the libretto is the words to an opera. And while their shows are still considered to be opera, they're much less complicated than a lot of the others. They're also designed for a family audience, which was unusual, because normally you had a lot of the kind of more racy music hall shows that people would come to see. And they really broadened their appeal because they you could bring the kids, you know. So all that was going on, and they were really popular. If there are any fans of Chariots of Fire out there, there's a scene in which the character Harold Abrams takes place in singing some Gilbert and Sullivan, which is what I really knew it from. Across the Atlantic at that time, writers were imitating and pirating Gilbert and Sullivan, but at the same time, new styles were arising. 1898 saw the first African-American produced musical comedy, which drew from ragtime and minstrel shows, and so that was all kind of getting knitted into the fabric of it. Some of the guys that were imitating Gilbert and Sullivan, for instance, in the 1910s and were very popular was a three-man team made up of P.G. Woodhouse, Guy Bolton, and Jerome Kern. So that was all going on. And in the Roaring Twenties, most of the musicals were really escapist and lighthearted, so it hadn't really got much farther than that. But on this side of the Atlantic, musicals were starting to grow, not out of the Roman and Greek and therefore operatic tradition, but out of vaudeville. And so that was something that was really different. You know, it was, and that's where the musical tradition, the musicals that we know today, really probably drew more from that.
Even how was it different?
Well, it was made up not so much of it's just the difference between opera and popular music. Music halls shows used popular songs, and they didn't have a story. The operas had a story, but they were very much classical music. It was something which people considered not really accessible for ordinary people. So to take something which is part of the operatic tradition, which is to say kind of the book musical concept of a story which connects the music instead of just one musical number after another, to popular music, it made it much more accessible. It made kind of the common man's opera, you know. And so it was wildly popular in the 20s. And you had a couple guys that were just really bringing in that American feel. George M. Cohan was one of them.
George.
We don't really remember him too much anymore, though his life, James Cagney portrayed him in a 1942 movie called Yankee Doodle Dandy, which people might remember. And he really began to pioneer the American book musical. Have I already said what a book musical is specifically?
I think so.
Well, it's basically, instead of just one musical number after another, the music has to serve the story. There has to be a story that connects it all. It's a play instead of a concert.
Okay.
So yeah, after Cohan, we had Oscar Hammerstein.
So a book musical is like which one? Like what? Give an example.
Well, a concert would be like, you know, the best of U2. Or the best of David Bowie, you know. Just
so any of them, any musical that we think of today, you're thinking of as a
yeah, pretty musical. Much. That was not quite the case at this point because they just had musical concerts, and musicals finally started. They started to meld all the different parts of storytelling. You had big musical numbers, but they were serving a story. Now Cohan began to start playing with that, but it was really Hammerstein that just took it up a notch. His music not only moved the plot along, but it also moved the characters along. It developed the characters. If a character was going to sing, it was because he was going to reveal something about his character, reveal something about his emotional development. He was singing because he had to put out some sort of emotion and tell the world that he was in love, you know, something like that. So the best and the first example of that was Oklahoma, which it came out in 1943 when he reunited with his friend Richard Rodgers, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein fame, and wrote the libretto for Oklahoma. So
would it help if I sang in the background while you do that?
It could be, yeah. I think actually we should just, every time we come to a musical, you know, you should just burst into the big number
you
from
think
it.
So?
I think we should have Skype so you could dance as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could do that. You could show them your Gene Kelly moves.
Yeah.
Okay, so I just mentioned Oklahoma and you just said, yeah.
Oh, do my favorite one.
Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day. I've got a beautiful feeling. Everything's going my way. So that's Oklahoma, which came out in 1943, and that really began the golden age of the Hollywood musical. And that brings up a question I was thinking about asking. What makes a good musical? I mean, why is music a good way to communicate a story? How is music a good way to communicate a story? And just to kind of give you a jumping off point, our pastor, about a month ago, well, maybe longer, preached a sermon about music and the way we use it to express ourselves. How would you say that comes into musicals?
Well, I think music touches us emotionally. It moves our emotions, and it can make a story more interesting, I think, sometimes by singing it instead of telling it. And I don't know, music just makes the world go round. It would be a lot more boring world without music.
Is there a specific way in which music can tell a story in a way that prose or just simple recitation, you know, of lines cannot? What does music add to the story? I'll throw this one to you, Patriarch.
It makes the words easier to remember.
Yeah, that's what I was afraid of. Well, all right.
How do I answer that?
Okay, I have an answer to that question.
Go ahead.
All right.
I think that music, and you were sort of saying this, is that it can express its emotions in a way, and it calls up emotions in the audience, and it's also a way, I think probably the best way of communicating joy, because you can have an actor who looks really happy, but music, it kind of draws your heart into it as well. And it, of course, a good actor, it can do that without music, but it just enhances the experience, and it also, I think, can...
Yeah, it enhances the experience.
It can... Well, we've been trying to introduce some friend of ours to musicals, for instance, and one of the said friends was saying, well, why can't they just say these things? Why do they have to sing about it? And I'm like, well, his daughter's just been engaged. He's happy. He's going to be a rich man. Of course, he's got to sing about it. That's what you do, you know. And that's—I mean, personally, I sing about—I sing when I'm happy, and I sing when I'm sad, and I sing most of the time anyway. Well, I sing when I'm bored. You know.
Think we're
and you
made.
Sing when you're glad. See how that works?
Yeah, there you go. You remember?
And we're on our way.
Remember the song, "His Eyes on the Sparrow"? It says, "I sing because I'm happy. I sing because I'm free." You know, and the Lord even, I think, commanded his people to sing to the Lord a new song, you know. And you see Israel in the Bible singing to the Lord after he has given them a victory, after he has freed them from Egyptian slavery and oppression. So, you know, and even in musicals, not only are you getting the words, but you're getting the instruments, and I think instruments have a way of moving us. I mean, violins, in particular, to me, are a very emotional instrument.
Yeah, yeah, it's, violins are just the best.
They're cool.
They are.
Yeah.
And this kind of brings us up to the question, with it, finally, the musical, as we know it, finally came together with Oklahoma, because you had music flowing from the story rather than the other way around. So another thing which Oscar Hammerstein introduced, and this was in 1927 when sound had just hit the film industry. Finally, you could with the jazz singer. It started with the jazz singer, and then further on, you could do movie musicals. But in 1927, Hammerstein brought out a musical called Showboat. Have either of you
heard of it? I don't know anything.
Well, he was the first to take a lot of the kind of lighthearted stuff from the 20s and 30s, and try and put some themes through it. He had a social conscience, and Showboat was about racism, and it was from the perspective of African slaves. Hmm. And that was 1927. So he was trying to do a little bit of that early on, and they tried a few more early in the 30s. But what with the Great Depression, everybody was depressed anyway. So they wanted to go back to nostalgic stuff, which they did for a while. And the 40s finally kind of brought us back to a little bit of social conscience type stuff. But the 40s through the 60s, probably, but mostly the 40s and 50s, but 40s through the 60s, were the golden age of Hollywood film musicals. It was something that everybody was connected into it. Everybody knew about it. Everybody was talking about it in a way that we don't really quite so much anymore. Hamilton was sort of an exception, but musicals, they've kind of gone in and out of popularity. So during that time, Rodgers and Hammerstein produced Carousel in 1945, South Pacific in 1949, which also dealt with some issues of racism, I recall, The King and I in 1951, and The Sound of Music in 1959, which were just, that was a really good streak for them. And this was also the era of My Fair Lady, 1956, West Side Story, 1957, The Music Man, and 1957. My Fair Lady and The West Side Story both drew from classic literature, which was a new thing too, you know, to try and incorporate that. My Fair Lady was an adaptation of George Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion, and West Side Story was an adaptation of Romeo and Juliet. Have you seen West Side Story? I really haven't.
I've seen bits and pieces before.
I haven't.
Okay, so we have
the Jets and the Bloods, or something like that.
Yeah,
we've just
passed My Fair Lady though, so it's time for your big number again.
Let's see,
what is there in My Fair Lady? I actually didn't like that musical all that much. I thought that it was very poorly paced.
Yeah.
And I didn't like how it ended.
Rain in Spain falls mainly on the plains.
Yeah, that's about the only one I remember from it. There was the one where she was talking about... I can't remember. I don't remember.
Well, I'll just...
And I hated that she came back.
I'll tell you, you know, just like in Mozart, Salieri, is that how you pronounced his name, Al?
Amadeus. Yeah.
He would hum his songs, and the priest that had come in, I guess, to, you know, offer him some solace before he died, you know, he would try and hum some of his songs, and the priest had no idea. Then he hummed one of Mozart's, and he's like, oh, yes, you know, and the priest kind of hums it and, you know, carries it out a long way, and I'm just, you know, just a common person, and if a musical has good music, good catchy songs, then I think I just find them more appealing. You know, some don't really have very good music.
There you go, musical makers. Make catchy music.
That's right. Catchy tunes.
Okay. So
I mean, like, who was it you were saying did The Sound of Music?
Rodgers and Hammerstein.
I mean, they were just masters of music that was really good musical, you know, good musically, and had catchy tunes that go round and round in your head. You know, you can still, just like with The Sound of Music, you can remember many of the songs from that, but My Fair Lady, you can't remember hardly anything. So I rest my case.
Well, my problem with My Fair Lady wasn't so much the songs, which were occasionally catchy. I just don't remember them because I didn't like the story. I thought that I really didn't like how it ended, and I thought that it was paced very poorly. But anyway, speaking of musicals that are not paced particularly poorly, that's where Singing in the Rain comes in, because I think it was pretty much the perfect Hollywood film musical. It was paced really well, except for one exception. And that's the Broadway ballet, which happens near the end of the film. But I can forgive it for that, because the studio insisted that this needed to be in there. The filmmakers were like, this is just, it stops the film dead in its tracks. And it has nothing to do with the rest of the story. So if you just trim that out there, which you can do with your remote, it's a great movie. It's pretty much perfect.
I don't agree. I mean, it has great dancing and great music, but it just doesn't. I mean, it's hard not to like Gene Kelly, but and the other dude, O'Connor, but there's nothing there so far as the story goes. You know,
I mean, that's kind of the point, though. You know,
it's not.
Well, it's a simple romance. It's the ultimate in Hollywood popcorn musical entertainment.
It's
the ultimate happy musical, anyway. I mean, you're kind of wanting a musical that's going to make you cry every 5 minutes.
No, he's
tender.
No,
tender-hearted.
One that's got some kind of a plot to it. I mean, that's what. Otherwise, it's a concert. That was a concert.
And see, you are just a lot deeper than I am. Like I said, if it's got catchy tunes, and after seeing Gene Kelly doing the singing in the rain, you know, oh my goodness. I mean, the rest of it could have been awful, and I would have voted for it. I just thought that was one of the coolest dance scenes that I'd ever seen.
It's
he just
something.
Had so much fun and brought so much energy to it that I thought it was great. And then the scene with the other guy,
Donald O'Connor,
where he, you know, went through the wall, I wasn't expecting that at all.
Oh, that was funny.
He just, man, that must have just been physically exhausting. He went so hard at that dance.
Well, the great
amazed.
Thing about it is that this is a movie which, or it's a story which has to be a musical. All those others, they don't have to be musicals. Les Miserables wasn't a musical originally. Phantom of the Opera wasn't a musical originally.
Even The Sound of Music.
The Sound of Music
have
doesn't
be.
Have to be. But this movie had to be a musical because it was about a dancer. It was about an actor, and it was about musicals.
And even when he proposes to her, he goes in where the scenery is.
It
and
had so to be a musical because there wasn't anything else there.
Well, it could have. It could. It's like well, that's
I mean, not
what,
that it didn't
but it's
do
about,
it good.
It's about musicals. That's the whole point.
Oh well,
and now it's also about the kind of the implicit artificiality of that genre. You know, he can't propose to her without doing some set dressing.
I understand.
And it's that's part of it. It's explaining to you what type of character he is.
I know. I'm just saying that that's his only weak point. I mean, because the parts that it does well, it does really, really well. But it just doesn't have any. It just doesn't have anything to engage you. I mean,
I thought the love story was very engaging.
Other than the music,
I thought the love story was very engaging.
No,
I thought.
Well, I mean, I just didn't. But
well, yeah, we.
because it was obvious from the very first beginning. Now again, that's a feel good thing, and I know, but
I like feel good things.
But I, but what's her name? The blonde was.
I can't stand it.
Well,
she
just
did.
Because there's not a decent
Lena.
Love triangle.
Lena.
I'm just saying that there's enough push back and forth. I mean, you could tell from the
it's a fun movie.
You could tell from the beginning of The Sound of Music that who was going to end up together. Now here's the thing. You know, I think that they had very good chemistry together. I thought that what they did for each other. I mean, you could tell they were going to end up together.
Yeah,
but
okay, granted, but
they also helped each other to grow as characters. There were character arcs. He was, for instance, very, very arrogant and assured of his place in the world, and you know, and he had to learn to change with the times, you know, to adapt to different styles of music. She had to help him do that. She and different things. And it was also about just how Hollywood had to adapt to that, and how Hollywood is kind of hypocritical about different things. It's sort of making fun of itself, and so you know, it's just really charming.
I like the camaraderie between Kelly and
Donald O'Connor's character,
and even Debbie Reynolds. I mean, you know, it was like they were in this together. You know, so often you see people competing, you know, in these later parts and stuff, but in this, it was just like they were, I don't know, going through life together and encouraging each other, and I like that.
Yeah. One thing, Debbie Reynolds was a teenager when she made this movie, which I just find really hard to believe. She's younger than me. It's just crazy. Of course, he was like 39 or 40, but they just she keeps up with them really well. They're amazing dancers. It's just a joy to watch them. Just
it's a lot like watching me around the house, isn't it?
It is. It is.
Yeah. Anyway,
and you might talk just a minute about the Sound of Music, Julie Andrews, and her
perfect
incredible
pitch.
She's
something else, you
singing
know. And I think that the thing about happy musicals is that you really have to cast somebody who can sell it with sincerity. Gene Kelly could do that. He had a smile that could, you know, light a whole street.
Yeah.
And then Julie Andrews could just stand in the mountains, and all the mountains were singing with her. You know, you could just tell. she was, of course, on the other hand, you had guys like Christopher Plummer, who was Captain Von Trapp in The Sound of Music, who said, he said, acting with Julie Andrews is like being hit over the head with a Valentine card.
Which, that would be nice.
And there's probably a whole line of guys lining up to say, hit me over there.
That's right. But remember in the, I don't know if it was behind the scenes, you know, interviews or what, but we learned that Julie Andrews had perfect pitch, and that they would just tell her, you know, sing middle C, and they would tune their piano to her voice, and that is just amazing to me.
I can do that. I just don't want to show anybody.
You can tune the piano to my voice too. I mean, it probably wouldn't come out too well. But.
Yeah. Well, the so let's see. We were talking about 50s musicals, and that I think that was Singing in the Rain was the king of that type of musical. It was. And that's why I would say that it's better than The Sound of Music because of that. It's a little bit less predictable, actually. But the 60s. In the 60s, you had Fiddler on the Roof, which was quite traditional. Another musical we know. This is where you come in.
Sunrise, sunset, sunrise, sunset. I'm going to sing that, you know, at... I'll sing that at your wedding, Hannah.
You were going to say you were going to sing it at your funeral.
Yeah. I'll sing it at my funeral.
Well, you know, this is your chance. You could record it now.
That's right.
And we could play it.
That would work.
You know, I kind of want to deliver a speech at my funeral.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. Could tell everybody how to vote.
I figure everybody would kind of do a little dance or something at mine. And
no.
Be like, you know, and Fiddler on the Roof when they're...
God would want us to be joyful even when
the stars right.
lie panting on the floor.
To life, look high.
I were a rich man,
Everybody's out there is invited to my funeral. So.
I think Fiddler on the Roof is just wonderful. I think Jewish people really know how to celebrate.
They know how to make musicals too. There were a lot of Jewish people I think involved in musicals. At least at this period, there were quite a few musicals kind of dealing with Jewish issues. A funny thing happened on the way to the Forum, I think, was one of those. I don't know anything about it, but it kind of came out at this particular time. Milk and Honey came out, and Fiddler on the Roof, which brings up a question: What does with musicals, you tend to have, because they're made for the stage, they have one setting. They delve into like one setting or one culture, something like that. How does location and setting feature into the story? Why is that an essential part of a musical?
No.
It's always with you.
it's just like any other story. Right. I mean, you have to have. Any other story has a setting, and it has, you know, that it encompasses, and that's the same with music.
Okay. Well, how is that important to a musical in particular?
Well, I don't know. Maybe a little more because of they have to. I mean, that's why musicals are so hard, because they have to write the music. Well, they have to, you know, It's got to rhyme. I'm serious. They can't just write like a pop song. It's got to be a song that expresses a certain idea or thought, right? And usually in a very clever way. It can't be, you know, it's got to be obviously entertaining and engaging. And so they've got to write that in itself is difficult enough. But then they've got to be able to put it into somebody, you know, in a particular character, and usually in a setting that makes sense too. But it's very difficult. I mean, I think it's a lot more difficult than just writing dialogue for some movie in a lot of ways. And so, you know, that may not answer your question, but I think the world or the environment that becomes part of that, right? And
I think part that of the music really works well because it's music is like shared history and shared culture. It's something that brings people together.
I mean, one quick comment is I think that if you set people, you know, even clever writers and stuff, if you set them down and you say, okay, you're going to write this, you know, this screenplay or whatever, and you need to stop at this point, and write a song, they would just be at almost a complete loss on what to do. Not completely, not everybody, but if you said, okay, I want you to write a song about what's getting ready to happen here, there's only a very few people that can do that really well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's, you know, yeah, I could do it myself, but it would be a train wreck. But the guy, you know, put together something like, Singing in the Rain or Sound of Music or a lot of these others we've mentioned is a real gift by these composers.
Definitely. I think that the setting is important too, personally. I just think about the scene where Julie Andrews, Maria, and Captain Von Trapp are looking into each other's eyes, and they kind of got the moonlight, you know, shining down on her and everything, and I think that really adds to the romance of those scenes. And I enjoyed Fiddler on the Roof and The Sound of Music because you did, you know, have lots of different scenes where they're going through the countryside, and I just thought that really added to the story.
I mean, I think that the best musicals, though, to some extent, are those that take place in a location which is really essential to the story. I think they're very good at taking you into a small culture of people, you know, a small enclave, you know. You have like a Anatevka is the location. It's about it's about a village. You know, West Side Story is about, I think, a neighborhood in New York City. Singing in the Rain is about Hollywood.
The Little Mermaid's about Atlantis.
Yeah, there you go. You know, you just build this little community, the Atlantean community.
Under the sea.
Yeah, well, you know, and we were saying, you know, we should do a game and say, and I'm bringing that in now, which movies would make good musicals? And you said The Godfather. And I thought, well, you know, that's right, because
Kill Bill.
Well, The Godfather takes place in a community. Now, of course, it would be just about impossible to write music which wouldn't make it trite, but it's got that sort of operatic tragedy to it.
I'm going to make you an offer you can't refuse. I mean, that's got a song written right there.
There you go.
You know,
I think
all I need is a beat.
Take
although it's probably more like a dirge.
Leave the gun, take the cannoli.
Yes, there you go. That's right.
That's a big comic number.
Those are two titles right there we can work with.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I knew it was you, Fredo. And then in parentheses, you broke my heart.
Yeah. That would be kind of the ending, at near the ending credits, right?
Yeah, you know, movies that are in theaters right now, The Revenant would make a terrific number. Exit Pursued by a Bear would be the big... big showstopper.
Luca Brasi, you know.
You know, Star Wars would be great. Star Wars would be good because Star Wars is actually a story which is so much about the music.
Going to the mattresses, you know.
Yep. Just hanging with my buds, going to the mattresses.
What were you saying about Star Wars?
I was saying Star Wars is a movie which really relies on the music to set the mood so much. We were talking the other day about, you know, how there's, of course, there's a scene on YouTube. You can find Star Wars without John Williams, a clip, which is really, really funny. The scene where Yoda lifts the X-Wing out of the swamp, it would have been really funny if it had just, you just heard things dripping instead of John Williams' amazing operatic score coming out in the background, you know. So a lot of those stories rely on music to set the mood. Of course, you know, when they're acting, some people might not know this, but they're not playing music.
Is that right?
Yeah, I've got to pick on Mom. She was under the impression they played mood music during movies. But they do on some, actually. I mean, they of course played it during Les Miserables when they were filming that. But anyway, back to a little bit of musical history. We had the 1960s beginning, and that was, you know, musicals have always reflected popular music in a way that opera was trying to be a little bit more classical, and the 60s began to introduce rock musicals. So you had the first one would have been Hair, which I don't know anything about. But you had, and that trend extended into the 70s, you had Jesus Christ Superstar in 1971, and then Godspell, and Grease. So Grease, you two would know that one.
Yeah.
So you, again, it's your big number.
I can't help you there.
You can't help me?
No, I don't have I don't got the pipes for that.
What are the big songs from Grease?
We should know this.
You know, You're the One That I Want is the big, that's the big number.
Yep.
And John Revolting sings it, you know, in stratospheric. That's it? I don't know.
Excuse me.
Well,
it's about, you know, hair jelly.
Dapper Dan.
This faded, well, that trend of rock musicals faded in the 80s, though. And you had kind of more nostalgic traditional scores, and then you had the biggies start in 85 and 86, respectively, were Les Miserables and The Phantom of the Opera. And they were pop operas, which were imported from England in Les Miserables' case and France in The Phantom's case. And they were also adaptations of classic novels. The Phantom of the Opera was really more of a pulp novel. It had never been wildly popular. It was, but it wasn't Les Miserables. So those were really formative. They were really a big deal at the time. So do you guys remember when they came out? Do you remember
the Les Miserables
or The Phantom of the Opera? Do you remember?
I remember, not really. I mean,
didn't we watch The Phantom before?
Well, that was a movie.
Kids?
Yeah, probably.
It was the movie.
But you know, it's quite frankly, a musical is not something you go see at the theater. It's just not, these days anyway. I mean, unless it's very exceptional. I mean, they made Les Miserables right a couple years ago, mm-hmm. 4 years ago.
2012.
How did it do?
Oh, it did wildly well, you know.
Well,
because Les Miserables was something that, if you weren't living in the boonies like we do, was, I think, had a big cultural impact. I mean, because they sold CDs, you know, they've done...
I can see that, I mean, but they...
They've done multiple wildly popular cast recordings of those, you know, that people have bought, and people listen to in the car, you know.
I guess I'm just saying that it's not... That musicals still have a certain, you know... stigmatism that comes with them that most people don't care for, or at least that they're not going to make an effort to go see. There are exceptions to that, and that's too bad. I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm just saying that especially with guys, I mean, guys just usually aren't going to pay to go see a musical. That's just the way it is.
Well, this younger generation, I mean, we've seen that ourselves, right?
Right.
I mean, they like things like, well, I won't say.
Like Hamilton. Are you going to pick on Hamilton?
No, she's saying that like, some people that remain nameless would rather see, you know, Mad Max. And, something.
Oh, right.
Joe Dirt.
Joe Dirt, right.
Oh, right.
And
well,
that's I mean, wrong that's, with this generation.
Well, I think that you're both wrong, actually, because a lot of people act as if, you know, musicals have gone out of style, but in the 90s you had the, it was the era of the Disney film musical. I mean, you had The Lion King. It's wildly popular. You had, and the first one was The Little Mermaid, and then you had Beauty and the Beast, and those were, so the
kids,
well, musicals were still part of the popular vernacular.
Like,
I mean, it was, so that was the 90s, but in the 2000s, you start the live movie musicals, which had gone out of style in the 80s and 90s, started to come back. You had jukebox musicals, which were musicals written to include popular songs. So ironically, that was kind of more like opera. It was more focused on the music than the story. You had Rock of Ages with Tom Cruise. That was a jukebox musical.
When was that?
2000, I think. I'm not sure. I didn't write it down.
I think Enchanted is sort of a musical.
It is. It is a musical.
And I really liked it.
And that's from 2006 or 7, I believe. So that's in the 2000s. The live action musical films were coming back. You had Moulin Rouge in 2000, I think. Maybe 2001. The Phantom of the Opera. They made a version of The Phantom of the Opera, which I don't know how popular it was, but I've listened to clips from it, and it's really terrible.
We just need to stop right there and say that there's only one Phantom, right?
And he does not share power.
Yes. And one Christine.
Yeah, it's
Ramin.
I did a little bit of crowdsourcing for this, just kind of to hear from people what their favorite musicals were. And I was expecting to get like two or three really popular ones, but I was getting just all sorts of different things. And I ended up in a conversation about The Phantom of the Opera and trying to kind of defend its storyline. All my life I had considered The Phantom of the Opera to be really cheesy and
possibly even
just an emotionally dangerous story which tried to glamorize darkness.
I couldn't get over the synthesized organ part.
And then the
I found that very cheesy.
And I also thought that it would probably, in the same way that I think Twilight does, and 50 Shades of Grey much more overtly, would glamorize an abusive relationship. But I was pleasantly surprised to see that it was in fact critiquing that particular type of glamour, and that is something which I think varies from production to production in its power. It's in the lyrics, but it's not necessarily emphasized in the way that it should be. I think that a lot of the Phantoms, like the original Phantom, Michael Crawford, he was kind of a softer type guy, sort of smoothie con man type, and he was, you know, and so you never really could hate him. Or he was never really evil and angry in a way that
he just hung people from the rafters.
Yeah, you know, but there wasn't as much of a sense of the director and the cast trying to make you actually look at his actions and judge him for those. It didn't help that Raoul, who was the other member of the love triangle, was kind of an effeminate wimp. You know, he had long blonde hair, just look, you know. Just looked gorgeous, and couldn't sing. And so the 2011 25th anniversary version doesn't have any of those problems.
Yeah.
Raoul is very masculine. He's a very viable alternative.
Yeah.
The Phantom, yeah. I think they treat the Phantom's character with a great deal of clarity.
Yeah.
His actions by the end are very clearly condemned, and the
he is very very passionate in that, and you know, I mean, it's like, you know, he's seducing Christine, you know, and she's confused, you know,
yeah,
about what she wants to do,
and she's really vulnerable too, because
yeah,
he's taking advantage of her guilt,
right,
and her grief,
yeah,
from her father's death.
It's almost like, and you know, he's, you know, drugging her with his you know, personality with his singing, and he's just so passionate and then
charismatic.
Forceful in parts. I mean, you can just see him switch from being, you know, kind of seductive and maybe almost tender to her, and then all of a sudden he's ready to kill someone, and he's very angry, and you know, just his that anger is just explosive, and
like Donald Trump and Megyn Kelly.
The Phantom of the Opera could stand in Fifth Avenue and
yeah.
shoot somebody, and nobody would dislike
That's
him.
Right.
Let's face it.
That's right.
I just think he really brings Ramin brings a lot of emotion to it. You know, with his voice, you know, he's a big guy, you know, so he's very commanding. I think he's not big.
I don't think he's all that big.
Well,
no.
I guess he just looked big to me when he...
Yeah,
the
Raul's
remember
a bigger guy.
The 25th anniversary one where he whisks Christine off of her feet like a rag doll?
Yeah. Anyway.
And Christine, what's the girl's name? She's just
Sierra Boggess.
Wonderful. She
She's
has
quite
a
good.
Beautiful voice, and I think their acting abilities are so much better, even Raoul's, than the other, you know, the previous Phantoms. And
I think that they give all the plot beats of the story the right conviction and the right moral clarity. I highly recommend that version. I wrote an article about it about over a year ago, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes. Even though with the caveat that I wrote it over a year ago, so it's a little bit rough around the edges, in which I defend the story and I explain what I think is so powerful about it. And in fact, just so that there was a kind of a part of it which reminded me of, which just felt like the gospel to me. But I will put a link to that. We'll move on. So anyway, you had the return of live-action musicals in the early 2000s, and that was Mamma Mia. You had Mamma Mia, and then you had Les Misérables in 2012, which was actually the first movie musical in a long time to be shot with live-action singing, which was a gimmick that I think was sometimes effective and sometimes not. It was super effective with Anne Hathaway. It was not so effective with some of the other numbers.
Russell Crowe.
Well,
walking around up there on the top of that there balcony.
I actually thought Russell Crowe did okay.
He's not as good as what's the other guy, Philip
Quast.
But I thought he did pretty well.
Walking
overall.
Be careful, Russell. Watch out. Watch that step.
You know, he does his best in movies in which there's a lot of water, and.
Yes.
He gets to sing.
He's the captain of the ship.
And he sings.
Check.
And he cares a lot about justice and stuff.
Check.
So that's like Master and Commander, Les Misérables, and Noah.
I thought you were going to say A Winter's Tale. Man, that was close.
Yeah, so anyway. And that pretty much brings us up to the present day, though I just want to kind of give a shout out to Bollywood here. I don't know enough about Bollywood to really talk about it, but I've enjoyed a few Bollywood dance numbers. It's like the I liked Pride and Prejudice. I thought that was fun, and it's a very westernized Bollywood musical though. So it's a good way to get into it, and it's a really crazy, absurd adaptation of Pride and Prejudice that you probably enjoy a little bit of culture shock. But I liked it. That brings us up to today, though, and now we've got kind of, like I was saying, musicals at their best tend to incorporate popular music, and that's what Hamilton is doing right now, and Hamilton is all the rage. And it, I think, incorporates popular music in a really interesting way, which serves the story. Now, of course, it's a little bit intimidating at first, because you're thinking, okay, these are the founding fathers, they don't rap, but... He's taking it and he's rewriting what they said, their words, into the shared language of our current culture. And that's what I was saying. Music is shared history. Music is a language. And so if you can take Hamilton and say Jefferson's debates and then turn them into a rap battle, you know, which is what he does. He turns it into a rap battle, and it's these guys trying to make their points in under a lot of pressure with music, you know. But it's the same words. It's them trying to make points about big things, you know. It's rap music, I think, has gotten a stigma of being just unintellectual or something. But rap is a really good way to convey ideas because it's a lot of words. It's
as long as you can understand what's being said.
Which you can, and you can't always understand everything in opera or either, you know. So it's just something you have to invest in.
Point taken.
For instance,
I understood every bit of that about Modern Major General.
We could tell.
Every syllable. I mean, it's just like me all over again.
It's like mush in your mouth.
I'm sorry.
Let's see, but like Lecrae. Lecrae is good. I've been trying to get into rap. I'm trying to be hip. I've been trying to listen to Lecrae a little bit. He's cool. He expresses theology through his rap, for instance, which is neat. You know, it's a really good way to approach that. And so a lot of, I think, theology fans like rap because it's a good way to talk about that. Like I said, it's a language. But anyway, Hamilton, so you have the rap battles of the kind of scrappy immigrants that are the founding fathers. It's trying to kind of reinvent them and make it a little bit less fusty. Say, look, these were young men with lots of energy and lots of charisma. You know, they were prepared to do all sorts of crazy things. And so their music represents the type of people they were, which is to say, you know, just a little bit radical, kind of edgy. And then you have the king, who's hilarious, singing sort of these Zen British pop numbers, about breakup songs to America, you know, which is really funny. And he's kind of more old-fashioned and more traditional. And so, and my favorite song in Hamilton is Wait For It so far. But I think that it's doing what musicals do at their best, which is to say, taking music and using that to express the characters, to express the story. What's that, Camelot?
That's from West Side Story.
We're
talking about Coming to America.
Oh, yeah.
And then that one, you know, is kind of the same thing. Because that's really funny, because they're talking about, you know, their ethnicity and blending into the United States and how it doesn't always work out so well. And that's probably from, I don't know when West Side Story was written, probably the
60s.
Probably right.
I can't remember. I have it written down here.
But that's kind of along the same lines.
Yeah, so anyway, the musical has definitely not died out. And it's just something that I think that, you know, it is not as popular as it once was, but it's still something that I think connects our culture and can help us to communicate to other people about things, you know, to take the founding fathers and make them relevant, you know, to say, look, this, you know, this, you can communicate this through a language we understand. And I think that that's what music is. It's a way to communicate to a shared language. So.
Oh, yeah. Agreed.
So anyway, we are now 59 minutes in.
Wow, we did well.
We did do well. We're professionals like that. And now we have to decide what our exit number is going to be.
How about Bring Him Home?
Bring Him Home. Oh, yeah, the patriarch could do that one.
Yeah.
Let's see.
I'm going to do a little number from The Little Mermaid.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Is this the end?
This is the end.
So are y'all going to do something after I do this?
I might sing a song. I don't know.
Up where they sing, up where they dance, up where they give a feller a chance.
You see, he can't take anything seriously.
Wonderful.
That's it. That's all you're going to get.
Oh, gosh. Well, death doesn't discriminate between the sinners and the saints. It takes and it takes and it takes, and we keep living anyway. We rise and we fall and we break and we make our mistakes. And if there's a reason, I'm still alive. When everyone who loves me has died, I'm willing to wait for it, to wait for it. Okay, I don't know. Well, we do. Let's see. We could do. We need to talk about what we're going to do next week.
What indeed?
We had discussed doing the X-Files because
we could do great sports movies.
We could. Like, what a great. I mean, we have to watch several of them though.
And yes.
Air Bud.
No, we can't watch Air Bud. We can't watch Air Bud because I might get choked up. It's an emotionally moving movie. So, well, I mean, the X-Files is coming out tonight in the X-Files, so we are halfway through the series. We could talk about that, try and do a spoiler-free discussion of sort of its cultural relevance, and maybe talk about some other stuff, because otherwise the Patriarch will get bored. He will have to.
We've got to expand our repertoire. We've got to put more content in our programs.
Well, that's what I've been trying to do today.
We got to do games and we got to make.
Yeah, that's what I've. So like I was telling you, a game. What movies would make good musicals? And I want to say, I want to turn.
I did,
and you said oh, I don't know, The Godfather.
Well, that was a good idea by me.
I'm going to turn that over to the audience. And so I want to hear some ideas, because that would be fun. We should get it trending on Twitter, and then we'd be famous.
Yeah. And but you got to put in a couple of the titles of the songs that you want to do.
Hmm.
You can't just give them the movie. You got to come up with a couple song titles.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you'd get, like, songs like Boyhood. I mean, not the movies like Boyhood. That's a movie that has a lot of music. You'd turn it into a 2000s era musical. So. Anyway.
That's fun.
So long, farewell, adios, and good night.
I am the very model of a modern major general. I've information, vegetable, animal, and mineral. I know the kings of England. I can quote the fice historical from Marathon to Waterloo in order categorical. I'm very well acquainted too with matters mathematical. I understand equations both simple and quadratical. About binomial theorem, I am teeming with a lot of news. Oh, a lot of news. Ah, with many cheerful facts about the square of the hypotenuse.
Many cheerful facts about the square of the hypotenuse. Many cheerful facts about the square of the hypotenuse. Many cheerful facts about the square of the hypotenuse.
I'm very good at integral and differential calculus. I know the scientific names of beings animalculous. In short, it matters vegetable, animal, and mineral. I am the very model of a modern major general.
In short, it matters vegetable, animal, and mineral. He is the very model of a modern major general.
I know our mythic history. King Arthur's answer paradox. I answer hard acrostics. I repeat it ace for paradox. I quote an Eliogarch, all the crimes of Heliogabalus. In conics, I complore peculiarities parabolus. I can tell undoubted Raphael's from Gerard Dowson's Ophanies. I know the croaking chorus from the frogs of Aristophanes. Then I can hum a fugue which I've heard the music's dinner for. Dinner for. Ah, and whistle all the airs from that infernal nonsense pinafore.
And whistle all the airs from that infernal nonsense pinafore. And whistle all the airs from that infernal nonsense pinafore. And whistle all the airs from that infernal nonsense pinafore. And whistle all the airs from that infernal nonsense pinafore.
Then I can write a washing bill in Babylonic uniform and give you every detail of Caractacus's uniform. In short, in matters vegetable, animal, and mineral, I am the very model of a modern major general.
In short, in matters vegetable, animal, and mineral, he is the very model of a modern major general.
In fact, when I know what is meant by mammalon and ravelin, when I can tell at sight a mouse a rifle from a javelin, when such affairs are sorties and surprises I'm more wary at, and when I know precisely what is meant by commissariat, when I have learnt what progress has been made in modern gunnery, when I know more of tactics than a novice in a nunnery, in short, when I have a smattering of elemental strategy. Oh, strategy, strategy, fatigy, matigy, batigy, I have it. You'll say a better major general has never sat a G.
Say a better major general has never sat a G. Say a better major general has never sat a G. Say a better major general has never sat a G.
From the military knowledge, wine, bucky, and adventure has only been brought down to the beginning of the century. But still, a man is vegetable, animal, and mineral. I am the very model of a modern major general.
Still, a man is vegetable, animal, and mineral. He is the very model of a modern major general.